The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
At that time, Robin Rass was pure hip-hop. The years before, in the beginning of the 80s, we went to New York and we went to a lot of clubs in Harlem. And we were the only white people there because we got to know Ice-T and Just Ice, and they respected us a little like DJs. So we could get a lot of influence from the American hip-hop style. She was very good at when she was on stage, even when we did tours in Sweden, she really delivered. But suddenly she didn't show up, and suddenly she was in her own world, so to speak. I was feeling something was not going to do right. So I said, no, stop the press. Let's do the backdrop like Leila Kay there and Robin Rass there. So if something happens, we could just take the scissors and keep the Robin Rass backdrop. And that's actually what happened.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
You were a big part of my early days on MTV because of your music, and your music was featured and also going to Stockholm. So this is a great pleasure for me. But I want to really go back and start at the beginning. And if you can tell me a little bit about your upbringing and what sort of music your parents listened to and when your taste started to diverge from theirs.
Yeah, actually, my father never listened to any kind of popular music, only classical music. Except for one artist, and that was because a cassette tape was stuck in a bar a car he bought, and it was John Denver. and then he started listening to John Denver, and each summer it was a cab, you know, so we went listening to John Denver. And the first time he because he collected music boxes, he had the biggest music box collection in Europe and a museum. So he was in a television show once, and Phil Collins here in Stockholm, Phil Collins were there too. And Phil Collins were warming up, and my father said to him, "I like you, you can be something in the future. You sound just like my favorite John Denver."
That's brilliant.
But my mother was a dancer in cabarets and stuff like that. So she was more into a little jazz and stuff like that. So, but otherwise, it was more classical music in my home.
So what was the sort of first record that you brought home, that you bought?
First of all, it was expensive to buy a record, but I remember I wanted to be a DJ early, so I had my first DJ gig when I was 11 at the local school. And then I actually got a job every Thursday at a disco for young people. So about 12, I was quite a popular DJ in my town. And but one of the first records was Automatic, what's the groom's name? Feel me, hear me, da. Automatic Lover. Cliff Richard, We Don't Talk Anymore was, I just got hooked by that song. So that's two of the ones I remember.
Your mother sounds like she was sort of in a cultural sort of scene in a way, by the way you describe her. Were you around people who were doing things culturally as a young child?
Yeah, a little by that, but she at that time she had quit doing that. She was home with us But they also had an understanding for us developing our music skills. So I went to take piano lessons and playing drums. And I was forced by my mother to play the piano. I was crying, you know, when I was 8 years old and went there, because I want to play the drums, you know. But she let me play the drums. Then we moved to a bigger house when I was like 10 years old. And then me and my brothers had a music room, and it was soundproof from the rest of the house. I got my drums, and there was a piano, and my brother played the guitar. So they really enthusiastic the music from the beginning.
So they were very encouraging that they really wanted you to be involved in music. What was Swedish music at the time of your upbringing?
At the time also, if we go back when I was 13, 14 and 15, they were encouraging the DJing too, you know. But at that point, I got a job Wednesday, Friday, Saturday at a club that had 18 years age, because they had the right to serve alcohol, and I was 15. And at that time, I went to school, and my father said, you can't work nights and go to school at the same time. And I said, yes, I can. And I show him my grades, and I say, I have the best grades in all, in the whole school. But so promise, if I can keep DJing at nights and keep my grades, if I don't do it, then you can tell me to stop. And he said, yeah, it makes sense.
Well, that's fantastic. What sort of music did you orient towards?
I was playing in rock bands, symphonic rock, and I like Saga and Rush and stuff like that when we were playing in the band. But I also, my heart was divided, so I also have this thing for dance music, and a lot of DJs in Sweden played a lot of rock, and I was trying to play more soul, funk, old James Brown, and more rhythmical music. So I was looking at even at an early age at the R&B stuff and soul funk that came from the United States, like Zapp, Roger Troutman, and stuff like that. And so I had to mix it in a little in the sets and start mission my work, you know, like a missionary. I play some rock songs here, but you have to listen to this too. And a lot of people start enjoying it, because at that time, in the beginning, we didn't have any radio to speak of, you know, and television, two channels before MTV came. So you have to buy the vinyls and just play it in the clubs.
What year was this? What sort of years? Was this the early 80s?
82, 83.
Because it was in the 80s that Sweden was changing quite dramatically. I mean, you had like the diversification of the culture in Sweden because of people coming from different countries, which happened, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and Sweden was changing. And you also had a big change in the music scene. How aware were you that there was something there sort of bubbling under and coming up?
It's true that what you say, we had a lot of influences from the whole world. And then we also have the Swedish folk music, like, and ABBA and stuff like that to look back. But at that time, ABBA was, everybody hated ABBA in Sweden because I don't know why, but then it changed. And then also we had in Sweden music classes in school. And we also had one thing that was very special, that you could apply if you were a band and you rented a place to rehearse or something. You can apply for some money from the government to make rehearsals and stuff like that. So, and buy instruments. So a lot of bands started like that. I was in a band and we shared the same place to rehearse with the Europe when I was in a rock band. And we were the better band than Europe, but they had this great looking singer and we didn't have a good singer. So, I mean, we went like this and they went like this.
When did you meet Robert?
We knew each other as DJs because we played in these clubs that started to getting dance music oriented and funk. And then I worked at a record store which called Vinyl Mania in Stockholm. And every DJ in Sweden went there to buy the records. And he was in there. And then he participated in the Swedish DJ Mixing Championships at 87, and I was in the jury. And he didn't do so well there. But then we start giving each other some gigs, you know, can you take this club and I take that one? And he said he's going to participate 88 in the DJ Mixing Championships. And he did, and he won in Sweden, and he went to Royal Albert Hall, you know, to the DMC competition. And at that time, we start talking about doing something together. And I won the same thing, Swedish Championships 89, and went to London, Royal Albert Hall, and the DMC Championships. And between 88 and 89, we start forming the concept of Robin Rass.
What connected you, do you think? What sort of music were you both into, and what did you feel really connected you? Was it actually a specific type of music that you wanted to make together, or was it just the idea of let's work together and try and be successful? What was the goal?
Well, yeah, everything just kind of got together in some coincidences, because we played a lot of funk, soul, and also dance music, and we had this British Bomb the Bass and stuff like that. A lot of DJs start doing music with samples and stuff like that. And at the record store that I worked, a guy comes in and leave a note. I was at lunch, and he said, I want a DJ or some DJs to start producing music, because that's what they do in England. And that guy was Claes Lunding. And he had just started Telegram Records and signed the Titio, Papa D, Space Lab, Jon Rekdal. And so the other guy in the record said, maybe this is something for you and Rob. And so I called Claes Lunding and say, let's have a meeting and see what we can do. And he had just started up. And so we went to his very small apartment in Stockholm. It's a one room apartment. And we said, yeah, we can do this. And he said, yeah, maybe you can do a song with Papa D. And we said, yes, of course. Where's the studio? And I said, yeah, I don't have a studio. Okay, so where's, can you book a studio? No, I don't have any money. So how do we do this? Well, you have to fix it on your own. And because we were very talented at the DJ thing with scratching and stuff like that, people will start calling us to apply scratches and stuff on remixes and production. And we said, yes, we can do that. How much money do you want? And we said, no, we want studio time. And that's how we got to get studio time and start working together.
I think this was in 88, wasn't it? It was actually before you were at the DMC. Can you tell me, because I watched that this morning, can you tell me about your set and what you actually played? Because it's, even today, to look at that, to see you do that, it's an amazing achievement, and it's really incredible. So can you tell me a little bit about that performance, as it were?
Yeah, the thing was that you had 7 minutes, you know, and you had to, the skills started just a few years ago to really get very in the whole world. I mean, it's, everybody was improving their skills. So before doing this competition, it was like a boxer going to world championships. I trained like 8 hours every day. And also tried to find the music that was with the good sounds of making cuts and stuff like that, but also interesting from the beginning to 7 minutes. We tried to develop some new techniques and skills. And we had also actually 88 when Rob participated, he ended his thing with playing on an old Deep Purple record, the Smoke on the Water, and then had another Def Jam record and played the melody. And that was the thing I had in my program the year before. And people were writing all this hip hop magazine. Ah, that's a new technique from Sweden. You can play tones and stuff like that.
I mean, a few years before, I think it was in 85, that the sort of the basis of Sweemix came about when Sten Hallström had talked about that the American and British remix scene was shit. And that, or sucked, he actually said, and that people needed hot remixes of individual tracks rather than a medley of hits. How aware were you of what was going on there and this sort of movement that was also, it was in parallel to yours in a sense, this sort of movement. How aware were you that there were really things like a scene bubbling in Sweden?
Yeah, I mean, it's very... Sweden is very small, and we and Sweemix worked together, and we were competitors. So Dr. Alban, for instance, I was friends with him when he was a dentist, and he had clubs and stuff like that, and I rented out equipment to him. And Sweemix also went to this record store, Vinyl Mania, and some of them, like Dennis Pop and me, we changed DJ gigs. I put him on DJ sets in my clubs and the same. So we knew each other. And then they start most doing remixes. And we did remixes also, but we wanted to do our original music. And then, so we were like competitive friends. And then in this store, Vinyl Mania, they had an office, and only Robin Rass and Sweemix could go into the office because they have some special records there. And they had this whiteboard. So me and Rob went to buy records, and then we did funny pictures like Sweemix. They were begging for food, and Robin Rass, they were swimming in dollars and made success and everything. And then when we come back, Sweemix had done the same thing with us. But it was competition with heart. So we knew each other very well and went to each other's club. And actually, when we started program our first songs, we landed their studio for free. And we also helped them with some stuff. So we were very close before that.
Because I remember that the ID magazine, they had a cover, didn't they? In I think it was in 87. Which was about Nordic Beat. And I think Camilla was on the cover, actually, La Camilla. And it was talking about Sweemix at that time. But Telegram was sort of like the last key in the puzzle sort of thing. Yeah. It was the last piece of the puzzle for that to come together. You said at the start you worked with Papa D in the studio, and you made two tracks with him. Can you tell me what you made and what the influence in that music was?
Yeah, we had just started out. And at that time, Robin Rass was pure hip-hop. And hip-hop was, the years before, in the beginning of the 80s, we went to New York and we went to a lot of clubs in Harlem. And we were the only white people there because... We got to know Ice-T and Just Ice, and they respected us a little like DJs. So we could get a lot of influence from the American hip hop style. So we wanted to do something downbeat, so when we started producing the beats, we wanted it to be heavy and hip hop style, even though we went to the club and played house in the evening. That's what we thought, that we was Robin Rass was going to be a hip hop band.
The album, the Eric B and Rakim album, how much of that of an influence was that on you? Because many artists cite that album as being really sort of of fundamental importance to their development. How important was it to you?
Just you name it, I get the goosebumps, because it was very important. First of all, the beats and the productions, and also the way he rapped and everything. We were like stunned. And that was like a eye opener for us. So, I mean, it's still great.
So how did it make you change? What did you change in what you were doing and develop from that, from Paid in Full?
Yeah, we had this studio that we could lend if we scratch at the productions and stuff. And we programmed our beats a little. But I had this idea to make an up-tempo song with, and I had this melody. And actually, I never told anyone this, but it's since it's not a theft, the inspiration from that, I thought, because at that time I was a lot into Minneapolis, and
it's Nasty Girl from Prince, is it? It's Prince's
more Sheila E. A Love Bizarre. Because I could play that in it was that tempo, and I also she had the melody da da na na da da na 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 na. I thought that's so brilliant to make. So we went into the studio and we worked with two engineers, and we had the beats programmed. And I said the melody is going to be like this, and I played it on an organ. And these engineers, they are very famous now as producer, and they have been to the States, and they listen to it and say, Is that so cool, really? Couldn't you make it more? No, it should be like this. And I was like, let's do this. It's going to be great when we take in the live brass and everything. And they were like shaking their heads. But then me and Rob was at the first, maybe because we didn't know Layla at that time. And we were about to make a third thing with Papa D. And Rob and me, we had fights over this every day, because he thought the song was too corny and we should be hardcore hip hop, you know. And I said, but I mean, let's do it. It's just for fun. But maybe if we find a girl to do it, it will, I mean, take off the hip hop thing. It's going to be more poppy and stuff like that.
So where did you find Layla?
Well, we have two versions. The official version in the beginning, the first 20 years, is semi-true. And because she participated in a rap contest and we were in the jury, and she came second, and we signed her because we thought that was a great story. But actually, a guy rapper from a male rapper from Gothenburg had sent me this tape with three songs before that, and at just in a bridge, like 15 seconds, Layla appears and doing something. So I had already heard her before this, and so I had her in my mind. And when she went to this rap competition, we could also see her. So then we thought, yes, let's try her.
How old was Layla K at that time?
17, I think.
What appealed to you, not just about her rapping and her voice, but what else appealed to you that made you think this could be, you know, successful with Layla K?
The things really happened very fast, because we saw her, she performed, and she had some charisma at stage. and she looked really good to do something pop stuff like that. So that, and I had heard her voice, but we didn't know anything about her except from that. So because in that time, nobody, even the small record companies, had no money. Producers, DJs had no money. We tried to get extra DJ sets to pay for studios, and so studio time was the key, you know. And it was so expensive to rent a studio, so we called her. She was living in Gothenburg, and we said, we have this song, can you we buy you some train tickets, and we try out in the studio. And we just picked her up at the station and say, hi, I'm Raz, this is Rob, get on the mic. And this, and we even had to find a friend to, we had written some lyrics, but another friend, MC Too Fresh, to write. He had a lunch break from his job, so he wrote the rest of the rhymes. So we didn't have time to, you know, small chat or anything like that.
Was she confident then? Because when you recorded Got to Get, she was very young. I think she was 17. And so, yeah. And she's come from Gothenburg to Stockholm. And I know today 17 seems sort of a little bit older than it was probably back then. I don't know. I feel like 17 back then was younger. But was she as confident and tough, or was this sort of a shy, different type of girl at the beginning?
She didn't say anything, and we only discussed the timing of the rhymes and stuff like that. And we did actually, of course, from the beginning, the song was called On and On, and the chorus was not Got to Get. And the verses were good, and she went back to Gothenburg, but this chorus with On and On and On, On and On and On, like it was... no, it won't do it. So then we took another train ticket a week later, and we recorded this Got to Get. But still, the same thing, that we never talked or went out for a dinner. We just focused on the studio hour. So she was working hard in the studio, and that's all.
Now, you said that the success came very quickly. Can you tell me about how that process was and how quick it was?
Yeah, first of all, nobody in Sweden had had any success abroad with dance music, so or rap. I mean, we had ABBA, of course, and some other things, and also Roxette was doing great with the pop thing in the United States, but... nobody really thought it was possible, but we were, since we had DJ that made these things in London, and we were aiming at the world, and we really wanted to do something international. And when we started, the song came together, the record company and the publisher, they thought, I mean, this is going to be a hit. This is great. And I was like, not so sure, because nobody has ever done it. So we always were very self-critic. I mean, as Robin Raz's team, we had unreleased 1,000 songs because we don't think it's good. And they say, yeah. And we send it around, and then we mixed it. And and we sent it to a record company, and that's where it started.
Was there any sort of special marketing method of promoting it in Britain? Because a lot of artists outside of Britain, and I saw that with people like Snap, would have like a fictional studio in Brixton where the record was made to sort of suggest it was connected to Britain. But what were there any special sort of marketing tricks around the song at that time, or was it, you know, purely the truth and it went by itself?
Yeah, first of all, how we came to get signed by Arista at that time, It's the worst coincidence story ever. It was like this. Another guy in Sweden called Jeppe Ekholm, he was with Simeon Hamilton in this house group, Clubland. They had some some popular song, dance songs. And his interest was like, and the side business was exporting a 12-inch record to the UK, to DJ stores and stuff like that in London. So he took some Swedish 12-inch from Swemix and from us, and he exported like 10 copies there and 15 of this, very small scale. So, and one record, so we didn't have a contract then abroad or just in Sweden. And so a DJ picked this record up, he listens to it, and he works in a pub in London. At the evening, he plays the record. And in that pub, in the same building, I think Gary Davis, the radio DJ, he lived in that. So he went near after work, you know, for a pint, and he heard this song that he hadn't heard before. And he was like into everything. So he goes to the DJ and say, what is this? I don't know. It says Stockholm on it. Can I borrow the record? I want to play it in my morning show. And then he took the record, and in the morning show, he said, yeah, something new from Sweden. You haven't heard this one before. I want to be the first. And he plays it. And in the car, listening to his morning show, there is this guy that have a friend working at Arista Records called Chris Cook, who is an A&R. So he calls this guy and says, you got to listen to this the morning show. And he comes in at the half, I mean, 30 seconds left of the song. And then he started to, yeah, it sounds good. I'm going to find this. And then he started investigating in Sweden, who is Robin Rass and who is Leila Kay and what is the record company. And that's how he got signed to Arista UK at first.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
So then it was released in the UK, and
yeah.
Very shortly afterwards, I presume, then you were suddenly on Top of the Pops. How did you hear about the Top of the Pops performance that you were going to have to do? And how did you prepare for it? What did you want it to be? What did you want to express?
Well, first of all, the Top of the Pops, I knew it from my very young childhood, because once a month, my mother said, let's go to the record store and you can buy a record, me and my brother. And they had this collection, and it was Top of the Pops, an album. And I think it was covers from great songs, but it was very good looking girls on the cover. And we didn't know what songs it was. So me and my brother was just arguing about who is the cutest girl and fighting over that. And at the end, we take turns of choosing. So that's how I got to know Top of the Pops. I didn't know it was a TV show or something like that. But of course, I got to know it later. But we had a very good collaboration with Arista UK, because we were like saying, you know this market, and we know it a little, but you make the decisions, you know, how you think we're gonna look and stuff like that. We don't care, do your best. So we were not like artists, yeah, this is my style and my, you know, we said, take care of it. And we ended up, you know, in this. I was so tired of visiting stores with designers and clothes and try things with a stylist and stuff like that. So pretty much we let the record company arrange it, because they did a good job with it.
Yeah, the performance is also very frenetic. I mean, it's so energy packed. Yeah. And of course, Leila Kay is a sort of firebomb, isn't she? I mean, in more ways than one, really. How the process of working with Leila changed over time?
Everything went so fast. And but when we were sitting in, you know, cars or trains or airplanes, we start talking with her. She was very good at when she was on stage, even when we did tours in Sweden, she really delivered. But suddenly she didn't show up, and suddenly she was in her own world, so to speak. So we had to, make arrangements that she was in time and stuff like that with other people, and almost like, in the end, private investigators look, where is she now in Stockholm? And, you know, and at that time, me and Rob was also very young. But we had been DJing and doing this stuff and working nights. But he was new to it. So I understand afterwards that it must have been a little shock for just from being nothing to a great star. But we didn't think about that when we were young, because we just want forward. We want to be number one. We want to be in the States and all the rest of the Europe. And so at first she went along, but small problems started to appear.
Yeah, I mean, she did have a completely wild reputation at one point. I mean, she was a lovely person. I absolutely really liked her. And I remember having a party at the Burns Hotel in my room, and Leila was there, and they rang up from reception and said, get that effing woman out of your room. And I didn't know why. And then later I found out what she'd done the week before, and maybe it's best left to the imagination in the hotel. And it shocked the guy so much that he wouldn't allow her back in. But I really liked her because she had an amazing energy, and she had an amazing character. But I just think that maybe fame was too much for her to deal with.
Yeah.
What was the process with Leila? Because at one point you couldn't work with her anymore. That was clear that probably, you know, that no one could work with her anymore. And that process was clear. So how did you have to change to develop without Leila? And maybe you can tell me if you know whatever happened to her and where she is today.
Yeah, we started to notice, as you know, things, because we were very professional, me and Rob. I mean, we went out in the clubs at night and stuff, but since being DJs, you can't miss a gig and you can't miss a time, you know. And the worst thing happened in Brixton in London, where just when we got signed and we started to, you know, get a bus in London, and some, I think some people from the German record companies and even from the States went to see us in Brixton. It was Soul to Souls Club, the Fridge, I think it was called. And a lot of journalists and stuff like that. And so we was going to do one song, but me and Rob started with this performance about 2 or 3 minutes with scratching and stuff, because we were known since we've been on the BBC and Royal Albert Hall in London and recently. So we did this short DJ show, and then got to get started. And it was always, it was never sing back, always playback. Because she had some trouble with the lyrics sometimes. And then she was supposed to come out, and the song started, and she didn't turn up on stage in the intro. And I remember people were screaming. I was thinking, it was 1 second was like 1 year in my mind. I think, okay, let her come into the first verse. No, she didn't appear. Okay, if she comes into the chorus, it could be a cool thing that afterwards to show it was playback. She didn't appear. And then the second verse, and then people start looking around, and she comes in the last bridge and do the last chorus and went out. And there was a Swedish journalist there, and everybody talked about what happened and why. And that's a lot of theories, but and then we did a lot of touring after we got big in the States also. I remember 1 month we had 36 flights in 1 month, and then it was like New York, and then back to the Top of the Pops, England, and then Philadelphia, and then Paris to do a TV show. So we were just, and I think she got kind of drained by that. And but the ultimate thing was that we did 1990, the first Folk Park tour. We had this thing in Sweden that people, big folk parks, and it was, I mean, they had like 20,000 or 10,000 people, or. And we did the first, we were the first to do a show with dance music, and it was very popular and very appreciated. And in the middle of that tour, we had a 2 week break, and everybody in the tour bus were talking, oh, so what are you going to do? Yeah, I'm going to go to my countryside with my family. And you, yeah, I'm going to go to Copenhagen to sail a boat. And Leila was quiet, and somebody asked her, what are you going to do? And she didn't have a plan, and she just said, I want to go to Ibiza. And I was like, oh no, that's not good. So I tried to talk her out of it, and she said to the tour company that if you don't get me tickets to Ibiza, I won't do the rest of the tour. And that's when she learned how to sort of use this if you don't, I won't theory. And I said to the tour company that don't send her there. And they said, we have no choice. And yeah, okay, pick her up at the airport when she comes back to Sweden 3 days before the continuing of the tour. And they went out to Arlanda in Stockholm, and no Leila appears. And I said, you go to Ibiza and get her. And one guy from the tour went there, and he just got a smack on his, like this, leave me alone. And then me and Rob got sued because we arranged the tour, and for a lot of money, because we had the contracts with these folk parks.
And how much money was it?
At that time, it was like 300,000 or 400,000 crowns, which was very much at that time. And we hadn't started getting any royalties whatsoever. So we had to do a lot of gigs for free. And we took in Dajin and Papa D and some other artists and thought, okay, let's do this show anyway. But it was not the same because we had the big hits with Leila. So that's when we kind of broke up and we said we cannot work with her because we wanted to do so many things. And even when we start working with her, we wanted to do with a singing vocalist and stuff like that. That was the idea of Robin Rass. And now when you have other concept groups like Swedish House Mafia or whatever, it's not a strange thing for people. But at that time, the journalists, at least in Sweden, they really don't understood what we wanted to do. So actually, in this tour, when she left, if it's you can find it on YouTube. I start feeling like it's going to be some problems. So before the tour, we're going to print this very big backdrop. And that was, at that time, it was so expensive to do a backdrop with the picture. And it was only one place in whole Scandinavia that could do it. And it costed like 100,000 crowns. And we should have the album cover, Robin Rass featuring Leila K album cover. And I was sending the picture, and I was lying one night and said, maybe Leila's gonna, I was feeling something was not gonna do right. So I said, no, stop the press. Let's do the backdrop like Leila K there and Robin Rass there. So if something happens, we could just take the scissors and keep the Robin Rass backdrop. And that's actually what happened.
When was the last time you saw her then?
Then everybody was asking stuff and we were doing our own things. We found Lutricia and David and stuff like that. And people were asking, are you going to do something, blah, blah, blah. And then when she was in prison sometime, maybe 15 years ago, she wrote me a letter and stuff like that. And I think Rob met her on because she was homeless for a while. And you could see her in like on a train station or something. But in 2016 or 2017, we have this mutual friend called Vito Ingrosso, which is the father of Ingrosso in Swedish House Mafia. And he was our dancer in the 80s. So we knew each other. And he had some contact with Leila. And he said, Leila wants to do a thing here in Sweden. It's not public. And can you do a get-to-get with her? And I said, yeah, of course, we do it. So we went to this small place and we did it. And people were like, what is this? And Leila on stage. And we did the two songs or so. And it went kind of, she almost didn't appear on stage and it was like normal. But then Vito started talking to her and I said, and also I talked to her and I said, if you want, we can do a setup. We can try to make a tour, but we have some demands because I mean that is we will always have a doctor with us because we don't want to be responsible for I mean if she's not fit for it or up for it and then maybe the tour company could get you an apartment and maybe if you want to study something like that we can fix that and if you want to get your life together, we can try, but we booked actually 4 or 5 gigs in Finland because we didn't want any Swedish press because it would be crazy. So, and the big festivals, and we went there and did, I think it was 5 gigs. We did 4 of them and it went well. But then I said to Vito, you must be at least 5 meters from Leila during this whole process and don't leave her. But then Vito went on vacation before the last gig, and Leila was living in a hotel, and then she just disappeared.
And that was the last time you saw her?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a terrible story. I want to go back a bit, because you mentioned the coincidences about Got to Get Going, getting on the radio in London and how that worked. But the American connection was even weirder with Clive Davis. That how he got to hear of the record, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it came to happen, but he was at Arista, United States. And the guy, the big boss was Roger Watson, I think, in UK. But I don't know how I got to hear, but when I heard it was Clive Davis, actually, we didn't know who he was. So I reckon, yeah, but do you realize that it's Clive Davis? Yeah, Clive, anyway, I said, just another record boss. So I hadn't done my homework quite so well. But he went to Sweden, and the guys from the record company, when we met Clive first, and Roger Watson were there, and they, the first time I've seen, they were nervous. And every record company guy and publisher, they were like shaking. And I was like, is it some kind of ghost we're going to meet? Because I didn't realize. And we first started to meet, and then we talked to him. And he was, after 5 minutes talking to him, he was like, you know, I had the feeling of this great, the granddaddy that you want to go fishing with. He was so nice. And he just made you feel comfortable. And we were like, this is, I've known you for years feeling, you know. But the record company guys, they were like very stressed.
So after Leila, you moved on and you worked with D-Flex or David and Lutricia McNeil. Created in essence a sort of different sound. What were you aiming for at that time? What was your goal?
Yeah, as D-Flex was actually in one song with on the first Leila album, and we got to know because he worked with Dennis Pop before, and it didn't have any success. But we got to know each other really well, so we became very close friends and still are today. And so we said, I mean, he was not the best rapper at that time, but we were so good friends with him, and he was so nice to be around. So he said, let's do something with him, but we need like a American gospel type singer, because we wanted this powerful, we want to work with rap and singing vocals and write melodies and stuff for singers. And then we found Lutricia. So we formed this DLC, David Lutricia combination. And Lutricia was living in Stockholm at that time. She's from Oklahoma from the beginning. And she was actually here doing a safe sex tour. And he met this Swedish guy, and she got pregnant. So she stayed in Sweden.
She got pregnant on a safe sex tour.
Yeah.
I tell you, that's a better story than Jesus and Mary, I think. how was it for you to have international success at that time in Sweden? Because it must have made you the focus of everything that was going on.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was like when we woke up late afternoon, I bought the newspaper to see what did we do yesterday. You know, it was always small notice and stuff like that. But the good thing for me and Rob was that we had been DJing for so long. So we were not feeling like, ah, now I'm a star and I can behave like I want. And the thing we liked was to have close contact to every. We did interviews for small radio stations I've just coming back from Top of the Pops that had, I mean, 10 listeners. So we said, and school magazines, one day it was The Sun and the next it was a school magazine. So we tried to keep our feet on the ground, and so we would just have, it was great for us. We had a good time.
I mean, with club hopping, you continued your success in Sweden. I think you had one of your biggest hits because of that album in Sweden. What it also, club hopping was also the name of the TV show on ZTV that you hosted. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how it was to host a TV show?
It was great, but we 3 days before the actual channel started, this guy calls me. I don't know him because I've done radio before in Sweden. And I said, yeah, can you do this show? And I said, yes. We said, yeah, always yes. And so we started with it, and it became very popular. And at first, it was only ZTV, and we were like hosting it. But they said, yeah, maybe we should do your own show more musically, and you can interview other, play videos and stuff like that. Yeah. And then we have started written club hopping in the studio. And I didn't say that to the TV show. And I said, yeah. And then since we're going to talk about clubs and artists, let's call the show Club Hopping. And they said, yeah, that's a great name. Yeah, we can do the vignette, you know, the intro. And the song was almost done. And we did a mix on it and said, listen to this intro. Yeah, it's perfect for the show. So then we market the hook Club Hopping and the name before they even knew that it was going to be our next record. But they didn't mind because they all pulled each other, so to speak.
The late 80s and the 90s were like a golden era for Sweden in culturally. There was so much going on, and it's sort of all built from that era, and so many people have come out of that era. How much do you think your and Robin Raz's, let's say, importance is in actually that whole scene and about bringing people, you know, forward because of your international success, because of what you achieved in Sweden as well? How big is that importance of Robin Raz in the late 80s and through the 90s in terms of other people and their what they could achieve because of what you achieved?
Yeah, the first thing should be that since we had the first international dance music hits, it was proof that everybody can do it if you do something good, because people doubted, no, we just from small Sweden, we cannot. And we were, yes, we can, you know. And so people got inspired by that. And also because the music scene was so small, I knew everybody that's soon gonna be work with music. And we have met in clubs and we were like friends. And so we could always give it each other and we could give them advice and stuff like that. And but I think the main thing was to see that it is possible, because a lot of Swedish people, even the record companies before, they didn't think it was possible.
I mean, often in music and also in my business, you know, once I left MTV, you know, the spotlight had moved and, you know, then I wasn't known and life changes and you develop in a different way. Although you were still in the industry, the spotlight had focused on other people. How was that period for you to deal with?
We always released some, we had a great success even abroad with the DLC and Nutrition in Holland and Germany and stuff like that. And then we came into maybe the year 2000, we had kids and we said, let's, we always had this studio and we started our first publishing company and production company in 1992. And instead of buying cars or watches for the money, we invested in the studio. So we said, let's find other talents in Sweden and maybe write for them, stuff like that. So, and also with the Lutricia and David, let's bring them in the Robin Rass concept and then make them solo artists. So we had this at the time very great studio, and we listened to demos and we met people in clubs or bars, and they say, yeah, can I come over and try? And we say, yeah, come over, it's for free. And then we signed some people, and some of them made success. So at that time we had toured so much, so it was nice to be home and actually spend some time with the kids. But we always had this, yeah, when we're gonna release the next Robin Rass thing. And so it was a good it was good at that time anyway. And still we had, as always, this DJ thing that we said, let's keep on DJing, because that's when we learn the crowd and see how people react to songs, and we can play demos and see the reactions and stuff like that. So I mean, it was not like sitting home every day, and we still did some gigs and some tours.
I mean, we talked about one of the first artists you worked with is Papa D, and in a sense, you know, we've got from 1988 to 2022, and you're still working with him.
On Saturday, me and Papa D are having a gig in Örebro in Sweden. And we did a record released last year, and we're working in the studio with the new songs.
Yeah, so clearly there's a fantastic relationship between Papa D and you two. So this is something that really works over the years. But one of the key things, I think, in obviously in your career, is that the relationship between you and Rob. What is the strength of that relationship? And in essence, it's sort of like a marriage, isn't it, when it goes that long, that you're able to deal with each other in good and bad and somehow still continue. What do you think you both contribute, and why has that worked for so many years?
The thing, actually, when we did this name, Rob and Rass, if we were what I call our band Fire, for instance, I mean, and be four people, if we don't like the third guy or even two people, I can say I own the name Fire, and you're off and in with another guy. But it was so connected. Rob is Rob, Rass is Rass. We have to keep together. And as persons, we are extremely different on every, we have nothing in common. And that's hard, but it makes it good, because I understand why he does something when he does it, and he don't understand why I do things, and he don't care. So, but it was always focus, and we, of course, we didn't always agree, but we were so connected, and then you become like brothers, and even if we don't like the same things, or even if we at times didn't like each other so much, so we have to do this. So we have done. Then he moved to Spain a few years ago, and then we were about to do we had an album ready actually, with some old songs and new. But then we start talking about that, and I have started so many other projects on my behalf, and he has started so many others. So we said, we couldn't agree how to work together. So we said, let's drop it. So now we don't have so much contact. We said, let's just time go, and maybe we pick it up again.
Well, Raz, it's been great to talk to you, because I think, you know, you and Rob, I have to say, over the years have made an enormous contribution to music. And you really, you know, you are one of the groups that have put Sweden on the map internationally. And for me, as I said, you know, in those early MTV days with Got to Get, with the Swedish music scene, coming to Stockholm so often, meeting you there, meeting all the other people there, it was a really great thing to be involved in. And I think you must be immensely proud of your achievements over the years, and to be a part and an inspiration for the Swedish music scene, which you have been. So thank you again. And yeah, I hope to see you one day on the streets of Stockholm.
Yeah, I was just about to say that you're always welcome here, and let's do like we did before, you know, it's not... let's just kick it.